All right, you guys. Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Also, lots of hatred of the cops. Here, wait, let's listen to this. I think this is Tamir Rice's lawyer.
And a Cleveland judge.
No, it's CNN talking over him. Tamir Rice's family is calling for a special prosecutor. Did you guys hear about this? You remember Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy with a BB gun. The cops just pulled right up. The cop jumped out and just shot him immediately. And the thing of it is that, there's a couple things of it, of course. The thing I was going to say is that there was news last week about the Tamir Rice story that, hey, some other cops did independent reviews and said that the cop's killing of the 12-year-old boy was reasonable. Yeah, it's completely reasonable. Well, it turns out one of the cops who determined that was one of the same cops who had written a report, an FBI agent, clearing FBI hostage rescue team sniper Lon Horiuchi for the murder of Vicky Weaver. If you follow me on Twitter, you know I always accompany these cop stories with the hashtag sovereign immunity. That was the case where I first heard it. George H.W. Bush sent the stormtroopers of death to wage war upon this small, helpless family in Idaho. Murdered a 14-year-old boy. Well, what happened was... Well, it's too long of a damn story. The Bush senior administration persecuted these poor people. And Lon Horiuchi, the sniper from the hostage rescue team, he shot this woman, Vicky Weaver, in the head. Basically blew her head off as she was holding a baby in her arms and holding the door open for her husband and their family friend, Kevin Harris, to run into the house. They weren't posing any immediate threat to anyone, but the orders were shoot to kill. The rules of engagement were shoot to kill. This American family of American civilian, American citizens under paramilitary siege. And anyway, the local prosecutor indicted Lon Horiuchi, said, you're not allowed to shoot the Idahoans in the head, or we'll prosecute you. And you know what the feds did? They said, you know what? We are moving this case. The Department of Justice is moving this case to federal court and making it a civil rights investigation. Not a murder case, not a manslaughter case or anything like that. And Idaho, screw you. And then guess what the Department of Justice decided? They decided, based partially, I guess, on the report by the same guy who cleared the murderer of Tamir Rice, that Lon Horiuchi had sovereign immunity. And that means he's a king and you are his lowly subject, not your equal citizens. And it's as illegal for him to murder you as it is for you to murder him. Oh, no, not in America. See, this is the old world where might makes right, and there's no such thing as the rule of law, where power is hereditary. You might have noticed some of these things. And Lon Horiuchi, free to murder Vicky Weaver and free to move on to slaughter Branch Davidians, to drive a tank in the final assault against the Branch Davidians, and also to fire on them from the undercover house across the street. And presumably hit them. Very talented sniper, that Lon Horiuchi. And see, so it's not all about white supremacy. In fact, at Ruby Ridge, it was a white supremacist, or a white separatist, at least, who was being attacked. And Lon Horiuchi, why, he's a government supremacist. All of our lives are worth about what a black life is to Randy Weaver. To Lon Horiuchi. And you know what? Randy Weaver, he wasn't even really a racist bigot, you know, anti-black guy as much as he was a backwards-ass Old Testament separatist type. But he worked for a black man. That was his job, was working at an auto parts or a auto garage. And his boss was a black guy, and they got along perfectly well. So it's not like he was going around, you know, picking fights with people, lynching people, or causing trouble with anyone. The only reason he was in trouble was because the ATF tried to get him to become an undercover informant, and he refused. So they entrapped him and then persecuted him. They set him up and took his family down, as the heroic Alan Bach put it in the subtitle of his book, Ambush at Ruby Ridge. Anyway, people love blaming Bill Clinton for that, but that was the George H.W. Bush administration that did that. It was also George H.W. Bush's government that set up the Branch Davidians. Remember, that raid happened only a month after Bill Clinton took power. Hey, it was Bill Clinton that ordered the Combat Applications Group, B Squadron, to murder them all. But it was H.W. Bush that set them up to be destroyed. At least his government did. People like to just blame Clinton. I'm for spreading the blame all around where it belongs. On all the guilty parties. But anyway, I'm off the subject, aren't I? Now, the point is, Tamir Rice, the same guy that says it's perfectly okay for Lon Horiuchi to murder Vicky Weaver, is the same guy that says it's perfectly okay for this rat, whatever his name is, this vermin, so-called human being officer of the Cleveland Police Department, to murder Tamir Rice. And I couldn't get the guy to answer me. I emailed him twice to try to get him on the show. Maybe he's seen some of my tweets. But this guy Greenfield, I tried to read through the whole damn article this guy Greenfield wrote at his blog the other day about the perfectly reasonable murder of Tamir Rice. And he cites case after case after case after case of how the courts have basically built this, you know, Israeli partition wall sized metaphor in the law to protect police from ever being held accountable for their crimes. The questions can only ever be answered from the cop's point of view, and only from what he says his point of view was. And if you still don't get it, well, you just don't understand the kind of training that cops have that give them the ability to see things in ways that are different from you, and on and on and on. And because of the 17 different loopholes, it amounts to complete and total sovereign immunity for any cop to murder any person that he feels like at any time, as long as he's on the clock. And sometimes, as we've seen and talked about on the show, sometimes even when they beat their wife to death on a Saturday night off the clock, they still get away with it. Remember the guy who murdered his wife because she smoked pot on New Year's a couple of years ago? And the cop showed up and he's like, oh yeah, it was totally a suicide. She killed herself. And they're all, oh good, yeah, let's help build that case. So just what a suicide it was. And the audio came out of the female cop that was investigating, that was initially questioning him on the scene. And she obviously has a huge crush on this guy. And it's going, oh yeah, and then you drank Miller Lite for a little while, huh? Uh-huh, okay. And then what happened? No question of whether it was a suicide or not. That's not what their job is. Their job is making sure that he is not held accountable no matter what, and even questioning whether he murdered her or not could interfere with that. It is true that sometimes a cop will get in trouble if he beats his wife to death on a Saturday night, or if he outright says, I'm going to get you, you N-word, on video somewhere, and says, because of my racism is why I'm beating you to death, or some kind of thing, then maybe he'll get prosecuted on federal civil rights charges. Otherwise, any cop can murder anyone you love or you and get away with it clean. Just like they did with Tamir Rice. And see, now the music's playing, so I don't have time to get to my other example, which is this kid Dylan. I forgot his name. I'll talk about it here in a minute. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Yeah, it's a show. It's mostly anti-war stuff, except also the cops, and then blam, just from there, tangent. I hate cops. Hey, look, this one's on CNN right now. This is what the one I was talking about. Dylan Guilford.
Sergeant Frost asked several times for Guilford's license. He refuses, questioning why he was stopped.
Am I being detained?
Yes, you are.
For what crime?
You flashed me with your high beams.
You had your wipes on, sir.
Guilford begins recording their interaction on his cell phone.
You can hit with the program and start to comply with this traffic stop, or you're going to be taken to jail.
The officer calls for backup as the situation escalates.
You do not have your driver's license on your person, correct?
Yes, I do.
Where is it?
You do not have to see it. I cannot see. You had your wipes on, sir. I'm not lying to you. I was just doing that to be polite. I don't want you to flash someone and have someone go off the road and crash. You know?
Do you realize that if you'd have complied with this traffic stop, it would have gone a whole different way for you?
The officer sees Guilford trying to make right a there phone and left. Call and orders him out of the car.
Out of the car or you're going to get tased. Everything's being recorded, son. I got no problem with that. Get out of the car.
Yes.
Get down on the ground now. Down on the ground
now.
Oh, my
God. Stop yelling at me.
Down on the ground. Right here, facing me. Down on the ground now.
What do you mean?
Get on your belly right now.
This is what American...
Put your phone down and put your arms out to your side now.
Sergeant Frost kicks Guilford's cell phone away.
Are you all... I don't have a weapon.
Hey! Get your...
You can't do that!
Get your hands behind your back. You're under arrest.
Just about 90 seconds before backup arrives, Sergeant Frost tases Guilford, but he's too close for it to work properly. Roughly 14 seconds later, you hear gunshots. Sergeant Frost says Guilford attacked him, hitting him repeatedly with his fist. Take a look at this slow-mo, frame by frame. You can make the scuffle out just a little more clearly.
Oh, yeah, right.
I shot one. Priority backup.
Seven shots. Seven shots. And, you know, see, here's the thing. Back to the racism angle on the police murders here. The reason cops pick on black people the most is because they know they can get away with killing black people the easiest. It's not that they hate black people just for being black. Maybe some of them do, because we are talking about a bunch of effing pigs here. But I'm just saying, that's not the source of the problem here. The source of the problem is they know that they will never, ever, ever get in trouble for killing any of us, really. They know they have immunity. They know that the entire purpose of every office of the government is to protect everyone else in every office of the government from the rest of us. The judges, the legislators, all the clerks and all the aides, all the cops and all the DAs, they're all in on it against you in a big conspiracy to make you their slave. And if they want to kill your son, they will kill your son. Now, what happened with this kid, if you watch, his name is Dylan. His name was Dylan Guilford. He was 17 years old. And you can tell what was the problem with this kid. He believed somewhere in there he had this cognitive dissonance, this doublethink that told him, hey, man, at the end of the day, you do have your white privilege of being a rich white son of a man with a professional job, probably, we can assume, right? And that somehow, it's not like he's really going to murder me. Wrong. Terrible assumption to make. And it's probably true, actually, that the cop would have killed him quite a while earlier if he hadn't have been a rich white kid. But comes down to it, yeah, they'll shoot you seven times. They'll shoot your boy seven times. And the cop in this story admits that people have been flashing their brights at him all night because he's a stupid ass who can't figure out how to turn off his high beams. Jeez, in some cars, you push the stick forward. And in some cars, you have to click it back. And if it's a real old pickup truck, it might be a button on the floor you gotta stomp on a bit there. Those are the three different ways to control high beams in the world, dumbass. But instead of saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry, officer," this kid said, "What the hell, man? Am I free to go or what?" He'd been taught all his life that he was free. So he tested it, and the cop murdered him. And of course the cop got away with it. We're not even talking about the slightest possibility of an indictment here. Not manslaughter 2, not manslaughter 10. We're talking about a civil lawsuit where it will be determined that the cop has immunity, the department has immunity, the county has immunity, the city has immunity, and you can go and die too. If you're lucky of some kind of natural cause, they'll see. And if they feel like murdering you, then yeah, they'll come and murder you. In fact, they might just murder you for daring to try to sue them. Because who's going to stop them? Who's going to stop them? Oh, well, geez, Scott, I saw on TV that the prosecutor's office and the police department are totally separate branches of the government and that, you know, if the one committed a crime, the other would do something about it. You can keep believing in them if you want. Devin Goolford is dead. Blonde-headed white kid. Said, "Am I being detained? What did I do? I didn't do anything." Cop kills him to death. And you know that at worst, the kid's neighbors are going to have to pay the family under the theory that somehow they are collectively responsible for hiring this police department, which hired this thug to murder this boy. What the hell is this, communism or something? Yeah, that's exactly what it is. From each according to his ability to each according to his security needs. And they'll take real, real good care of you too. Sickening. Anyway, there's no end to it. Just wait, man. Monday... We're going to talk with Keegan Stephan, and we're going to do this every Monday from now on. That's the thing. We're going to make a thing out of this. And Keegan is going to spend, you know, 20 minutes, two 10-minute segments of his interview, going down the list of everybody the cops murdered this week. And you're going to see how we just can't cover them all. There's no way to. They kill 2-3 people a day, every single day. Your security force that you can't fire. Hey, at least I know I'm free, even though I don't have a choice who my security force is, and they can kill me and get away with it if they want, but, you know. Other than that, though, I can do whatever I want that they say is okay to do if I get a license first. Pay all my fines and fees and tax stamps first. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, interesting footnote to that story, guys. I was just reading the New York Daily News version of it. And the cop claims that because the kid was saying, am I being detained, and was flexing his rights, that the cop had been trained to know that that's part of a right-wing terrorist militia lingo. And so when the kid called his girlfriend, the cop assumed he was calling the militia to come to fight and kill the cop. And so that was part of why he had no choice but to execute this helpless, unarmed boy on the side of the road. And then liberals everywhere rejoiced and took back their criticism of the cop for murdering this guy. Because as all liberals know, gun control and the war against white people who may or may not know other white people with guns is paramount. And they have no rights at all, and they should be gunned down like dogs, just as this kid was. And they celebrated throughout the land, and they took back all their criticisms of the cop for murdering the boy. Okay, I just made up the last part, but yeah, you know that's how they feel about it. Anyway, on to our first guest today. It's the great Gareth Porter. What he does is journalism debunking all the things that they would have you think about the countries that they bomb. That's basically his beat. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Scott. Glad to be back again.
Very happy to have you here. Okay, so a couple of very important stories here. And yeah, I know I already had you on this week, but I like what you read, okay? So that's the deal. And everyone, please read his book. It's Manufactured Crisis, The Truth Behind the Iran Nuclear Scare. And it's a masterpiece, and I do hope that you'll know all the things in it. Obama won't admit the real targets of Russian airstrikes. This is the column at Middle East Eye, and we got into this a little bit in the last interview. But anyway, it's sure worth it. No one is discussing the reality that the Russian offensive is targeting the biggest militant threat to the Assad regime. And you're referring here to kind of the tortured phraseology and summary and narrative on NPR and the New York Times and the Lehrer NewsHour and all the official places where they say what the news is. We're supposed to be very upset that the Russians promised to only attack ISIS, but now they're not attacking ISIS. They're attacking the opposition to Assad. And this is very upsetting to us all.
Right. And the implication, and in many cases, very explicit suggestion here, is that it's the moderates that the United States has been supporting who are the targets of the Russian airstrikes. And so that is what gives this story such power, I would say, to shock the liberal imagination and the centrist and virtually everybody else in the public who's not following this story very, very closely.
Yeah. So, well, break it down.
So, you know, what I have discovered very quickly from looking carefully at the maps that you can find in the New York Times and other newspapers, and especially the original source where those maps actually are coming from, the Institute for the Study of War, which is essentially a neocon offshoot, but that does some very useful research. And in this case, I think it is very important to check out the actual maps, because what they show, and they've tracked this almost day to day from the beginning of the Russian air campaign in Syria, is that the overwhelming majority, and I'm estimating 95% or even more of the Russian airstrikes are focused on Idlib province, Hama province right next to Idlib, the part of Hama province next to Idlib, and a little bit of Latakia province, which also abuts Idlib province. And these strikes are clearly aimed at the forces which are essentially al-Nusra Front, meaning the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria, and their military allies as part of what they call the Army of Conquest, which essentially took over Idlib province earlier this year, beginning in March and sort of concluding, finally, wrapping it up in April. And so what the Russians are doing is trying to push back against the essentially al-Nusra Front-led forces. Arar al-Sham is perhaps the second most important military force involved in Idlib, and they are hardline jihadist forces as well, and you know, essentially controlled by al-Qaeda alongside al-Nusra Front. And so this is the key point about the misleading stories that have been carried by the news media, and which, of course, are based on the rather indignant statements by the Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter and the White House about the military offensive by the Russians in Syria.
All right, now, so to what degree does the FSA exist separate from the Army of Conquest, et cetera?
That's a very good question, Scott. And of course, you know, technically, the FSA still does exist, and they may even have a presence, indeed, in that area. But they are an insignificant force alongside the forces that I've just discussed, al-Nusra Front, Arar al-Sham, and the other jihadist groups that have grouped under the so-called Army of Conquest. And so, you know, it seems to me the FSA now has, for many months, has served essentially as an excuse for certain parties to send weapons to the Army of Conquest.
Right.
And I don't know exactly the details of how this works, but I don't believe for a moment that the United States is still sending weapons to the FSA per se. They did send weapons, and this is, you know, what I talk about in my story. They were sending weapons up until early this year to the organization called Harakat Hazem. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, but that was essentially the last holdout, which could be called a moderate armed group in the Idlib area. They were, in fact, still holding out against the forces of al-Nusra and Arar al-Sham and their allies, but they were taken over essentially by al-Nusra Front and their allies in March or late February, early March of 2015, and essentially disappeared. I mean, they essentially broke up, and all of their weapons, as far as we know, were essentially taken over by the al-Nusra Front and their allies.
Mm-hmm. And well, we've seen that process repeat itself over the years, too.
Well, that's of course right. That is what has been happening for years now.
Well, now, but what even makes these groups moderate at all in the first place? Just they're willing to cooperate with the Americans and the Israelis?
Well, before I answer that, let me just make one final point, which, you know, is very important in this context, and that is that what happened when Harakat Hazem was taken over, disappeared, and its assets were taken over by al-Nusra Front and their allies, is that that's how they obtained hundreds of TOW anti-tank missiles, which have turned out to be the critical factor in the ability of this Army of Conquest to make such rapid and dramatic strides in that part of northwest Syria. So anyway, I just want to make sure that point got in there. Now, so your question is, What makes a group moderate, a so-called moderate group in the Syrian context?
Yeah, like the Al-Faruq Brigade, they used to call for elections. This has been a couple of years, but they said, yeah, no, we should call elections. We shouldn't, you know, force everyone to convert or die or anything like that. We can coexist. But then it was their commander who was on film eating the dead soldier's heart. And then there was the Northern Storm Brigade who piled around with John McCain. But then they were the ones who sold Sotloff to ISIS and admitted on camera to Time magazine that they were veterans of the Iraq war where they fought with Zarqawi. So I was just wondering, I mean, here the FSA commanders are saying we're planning suicide attacks against the Russians. So where's the moderation? That's all I'm asking. Now we got to take this break. We'll be right back with Gareth, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So, yes, I don't mean to just get caught up on semantics. It's an important point whether there really is a moderate third force for America and its allies to back against Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Assad and his army and Hezbollah and Iran and Russia. Is there, Gareth?
You know, that's
never mind whether
question.
It's strong enough to really do what I just said its task right. is. But are there any goddamn moderates at all here? This is stupid
yeah,
wise.
I mean, your question of your original question is what constitutes moderates? And I don't know if anybody really knows the answer to that. My impression was that at the beginning of this whole saga, that it actually meant something approaching, you know, at least relative secular orientation of the military unit. But that, I don't know if that has held up at all. I doubt it.
Yeah, cannibalism notwithstanding.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, I mean, the bottom line is I really don't know how that would be defined at this point. And even if there were an internal definition, I doubt very much that the American public would be told the truth about, you know, how it's being used.
Yeah. And now this was the last story in the last interview. We talked about this too, how, you know, the Al-Nusra Front and their allies, people just like them in every way, have dominated the field all along. Unlike in Iraq War II, where Al-Qaeda in Iraq was really a more marginal part of the Sunni-based insurgency, they really have dominated the field on the Sunni side of the war, if you can call it that. Obviously, there are a lot of Sunnis that back the Damascus government as well. But anyway, it's always been the al-Nusra Front from the very beginning that's dominated this thing. And then so that's what gets us right back to the ridiculous contradiction now where our government is crying that the Russians are bombing Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, and you know, the bottom line for me, the last point that I make in my story about this issue of the Obama administration and the news media essentially refusing to acknowledge the fundamental truth about what's going on there at this moment is that, you know, the reason it seems to me is very clear that they are afraid for the truth to be told about this. That is that the Obama administration entered into a very complicated set of arrangements last year with the Qataris and the Saudis, which involved essentially cooperating in supporting the forces in the northwest Syria that were building up to take over Idlib province. And they, you know, they were supporting what the Qataris and the Saudis were doing here on the ground that, at least according to Liz Sly's story in the Washington Post this past week, this would represent enough pressure on the Assad regime to force Assad to compromise, meaning presumably that he would agree to step down, but without risking the collapse of the entire state structure.
And they didn't even question whether they were going to risk an invasion by the Russians. That wasn't even part of it, huh?
That was not part of it at all. But the point is that they were involved in such an incredibly risky, totally irresponsible notion of a policy that, you know, I think they would be embarrassed to have this whole issue aired at all. And I think that's the real problem at this point.
Yeah, Tom Engelhart had an article came out yesterday about how the guys in military intelligence, where they can't get a damn thing right. Everything that they estimate is off by a lot. Like, here's some quotes of some guys just a few weeks ago saying, oh, Kunduz will never fall. I mean, yeah, the Taliban are doing some small attacks near it, but don't worry, it's fine.
Well, you know, that kind of...
Mosul's not in danger, Gareth. You don't need to worry about the Islamic State taking over Mosul. Nah.
Nothing to see here. Move on. Yeah, I mean, this is of course, the system of U.S. military command in Afghanistan at work. And I know from the Petraeus era that when anybody in the military intelligence would suggest an analysis or even a report of what was happening on the ground, very concrete report that conflicted with the good news trend that Petraeus wanted to get out, they were very strongly discouraged by the commanders there from moving forward with that. So that's the way it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's his name, Daniel, the officer that you interviewed.
Daniel. Sorry.
I'm sorry. That's on the tip of my tongue too.
When it comes up without preparation,
it's all right.
I know perfectly well.
Yeah. Anyway, you know what? Here's something I can mention that talks about that, that shows that in action, actually, is a Vice documentary from 2 or 3 years ago called This Is What Victory Looks Like, where everything is a catastrophe, and then the brass come to visit, and they're like, everything's great.
Yes,
and don't dare to tell the truth, because they already know it's not allowed. Anyway, hey, let's talk about your Yemen story here. We still got 5 minutes. The U.S. could end Saudi war crimes in Yemen. It just doesn't want to. What war crimes, and how could America do anything about that, Gareth?
Right. I mean, here's another story that's not covered by the news media. Amnesty International issued a report on October 6th, I believe it was, which documented in great detail the war crimes that the Saudi-led coalition was carrying out, has been carrying out in Yemen since March 27th. And they actually visited Yemen during the summer. And what they found, first of all, of course, they actually were able to quote the Saudi spokesman, the spokesman for the Saudi command, who publicly declared that the Saudis and their allies were going to bomb the two major cities in the north, Sana'a and another city which I was not familiar with, a smaller city, and they were going to do so because not that they were specific military targets that they were going to hit, but because these cities were supporting the Houthis. And the population, therefore, I mean, they didn't use this phrase, but of course it was the practice of the well-known principle of collective responsibility that the Israelis more or less follow explicitly in their wars. So, I mean, this was the primary war crime, the one that covered many other specific war crimes in the case of Yemen.
And just reading from your article here, it's Sada and Maram. Maram.
So, this Amnesty International report is really quite damning, and the point I make in the article is that first of all, the Obama administration refuses to make any comment on the Amnesty International report, and they're not asked to make any comment except by me, because the news media is simply refusing to report on that Amnesty International report, except for, I believe, one Time magazine piece which misrepresents it, suggesting that there could be war crimes instead of saying that there were war crimes.
Right. Okay, now tell me everything you know about what America has to do with this Saudi war in Yemen.
Right. I mean, what Amnesty points out very specifically is that the United States is liable under international law for the Saudi-led coalition of war crimes because, A, the United States is supplying the munitions. I mean, that's very clear on the record. We sold the munitions to the Saudis. Secondly, that war could not go on without the U.S. providing the logistical support for it. In other words, keeping those airplanes flying. It's very well known that the Saudis can't do it themselves, nor can the other members of their coalition. They have to have U.S. contractors basically carrying out that function in order to keep that war going. So, so the U.S. is legally liable under international law because of their very serious involvement in supplying the weapons and the logistics. Now, you know,
let me ask you this. Wait a minute. Who's zooming who here? Because America's the empire and Saudi is the satellite state. And how about this is America's war, the Republicans and the Democrats and the Pentagon's war. And they've just kind of hired the Saudis to do the bombing runs for them for PR purposes.
No, that's not what happened, Scott. You know, that may be one of the easy things to take away. But the fact is, as far as I know, the United States was not told about this until the last minute. And I think that's perfectly credible because of the way the new Saudi government has operated. I mean, this is a bunch of people who really have no experience whatsoever. I mean, the Minister of Defense is this kid, 29-year-old guy who is apparently a disaster in a number of different ways, and who has no real experience and who just is operating by the seat of his pants. But the point is that the Obama administration said, oh, okay, sure, go ahead, we'll support you. And, I mean, that's the real crime. I mean, you know, that
well,
they...
Well, it's been half a year now, and a blockade and all of this. I mean, this is not nothing. This is huge.
I mean, you know, absolutely, the Obama administration is fully culpable. They decided to let them go ahead and see what they could do, and they are unwilling to do anything about it. That's the burden of my story. That's the main point that I make. Mm-hmm. Even though they know it's a disaster, they know that the consequences of this are disastrous. For one thing, it gives Al-Qaeda a complete open space to operate. And then they've been cleaning up. They've been basically making huge strides because of this war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and, you know, it's not like they don't know this. I interviewed Mark Perry about, I don't know, 3-4 months ago, and he had a story about how over at the Pentagon, they were saying, yeah, you know what, we don't like flying as Iran's air force in Iraq, but they got us flying as Al-Qaeda's air force in Yemen, and this is crazy. Right. And, you know, the Pentagon, they're happy to bomb anybody, but they don't really want to fight on Al-Qaeda's side. They got hit that day, after all, you know?
And the CIA is not happy with this at all. I mean, they think that this is a disaster because of their interest in, you know, the counterterrorism aspect of Yemen. And so they see Al-Qaeda, you know, making huge strides because of this war, and they're not happy about that. I mean, certainly the intelligence people are not happy, and arguably the people who are involved in counterterrorism in Yemen are also unhappy about what the U.S. is doing in supporting this stupid war in Yemen.
It's amazing. And, you know, the partisan incentives baked into the Obama reign are going to be something for historians to puzzle over, assuming mankind survives for eons to come. The way the conservatives love war, but they hate Obama, so they don't want to give him credit for the wars that he does. They only accuse him of not ever doing enough, but they won't ever really highlight just how militaristic he is and all the horrible sins that he commits. And all the liberals want to pretend that they elected Dennis Kucinich and that the war ended back in 2011 and everything's fine now. And they just, you know, willfully ignore it. You have the major media who can hardly understand it to even squawk about it. You know, the news anchors still wondering what's taking so long to get rid of Assad. And this is how history's written.
The news media are totally complicit in both Yemen and the Syrian stories. The crimes that are being committed in both places. And you know, do they know what they're doing? You know, yes and no, I think is the answer. It's more complicated than that. So, I mean, that's for another discussion to get into greater depth on. But, you know, I just would say that, you know, we're up against a system in which the Obama administration is really lost in a fog about what they're doing. I really think that there's a new phenomenon here of the national security state being moved in a direction that is completely new, where there's no real strategy. They're operating by the seat of their pants and trying to cover up for the stupid things that they've done in the past. And that's, I think, really the story at this point.
Yeah. hey, you know what? As long as it's good for arms sales and as long as it's good for, you know, the ribbon manufacturers who get to supply all the fancy brass with their shiny little decorations for their uniforms, I guess they'll keep on going.
Well, I'm not sure how many ribbons are being handed out at this point over the crimes in Yemen. That's for sure. And at Syria as well. I mean, that's not clear that that's generating many ribbons at this point.
Yeah, well, you know, just wait till Jeb comes and we have the Presidential Medal of Freedom ceremonies for those who saved Yemen from the Houthis or whatever it is. Anyway,
we'll see about that.
I kept you way over time. Thanks, Gareth. Okay. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
All right, y'all. That's the great Gareth Porter. The U.S. could end Saudi war crimes in Yemen. It just doesn't want to. That's at truthout.org, and this one is at MiddleEastEye.net. Obama won't admit the real targets of Russian airstrikes. America's Al-Qaeda forces. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Huh. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So that was Gareth the Great. Here's one in McClatchy, D.C. Christians, others fighting to survive in the age of the Islamic State. Yeah, Saddam Hussein, he was a mean son of a bitch, but he had a monopoly on power. And he didn't allow a bunch of right-wing religious kooks of the Shia or Sunni persuasion to go around murdering Christians and Jews and Druze. But he's gone. Because of somebody I know. Somebody you might remember. Bunch of somebodies who cheered it on. And anyway, it's Hannah Alam at, I guess, what's left of McClatchy Newspapers here. And, yeah, it's the same thing in Iraqi Shiistan as it is in Sunnistan, a.k.a. the Islamic State right now. In Iraq, according to the State Department report, church leaders estimate that only about 500,000 Christians remain from a population that once numbered as many as 1.5 million, 1.4, they say. The report says that up to 200,000 Christians, some 300,000 Yazidis, and thousands of Kakais... Cockeyes? Huh. Are among nearly a million Iraqis who've been internally displaced. Entire populations of religious minority groups. Last I read, there were 8 Jews left in Baghdad, and there had been hundreds. It was a small community, but they weren't under any, you know, specific persecution while they lived there. Entire populations of religious minority groups have been targeted for killing. Terrified young girls have been separated out by religion and sold into slavery, which is apparently true. I'm sure they're making the most of it in their Belgian babies on bayonets kind of way, but there does seem to be truth behind that. The Islamic State particularly making sex slaves out of the Yazidis. But this kind of thing has been going on since when, class? 2003. That's right. Let's go out to recess early today. Same thing's going on in Libya, they're saying here, too. I don't know which different... there's much ethnic cleansing still going on in Libya. Of course, you do remember Barack Obama riding into Libya
in his green robes and hood as the Imperial Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, leading Al-Qaeda in their anti-black pogroms. They're not really white supremacists, they're Arab supremacists. And because Gaddafi had hired some blacks and some Tuaregs to be mercenaries in his little protection squad, he didn't have enough much of a military, more like his own little personal Gestapo, basically, his own internal security force. And because some of them were black and were Tuaregs, well, then it became understood very quickly among the Al-Qaeda fighters that all blacks and Tuaregs, and I don't know how many Tuaregs there were that weren't working for Gaddafi, but certainly the rumor went around that all blacks are basically working for Gaddafi. And especially in the city of Sirte, there were thousands and thousands, maybe, I don't know, tens of thousands or more of them, who were rounded up. I guess some of them forced to God knows where, many of them killed. You might remember David Enders reporting from a refugee camp where many women told very credible stories of the Mujahideen coming and raping them every night. And it wasn't the kind of thing that the American, you know, war propaganda the Americans were highlighting, like when Susan Rice pretended that, and I think Amnesty International and some of the other human rights groups got in on it when they insisted that Gaddafi was passing out Viagra to his massive army to go raping their way across Libya. Yeah, right. He hardly had an army. And if they were raping their way across Libya, how are they doing any fighting? And that was an obvious lie. And I've said this before, but it's one of those that I'll just never forget because it's a fun little scene. I was driving west down Sunset Boulevard, stuck in traffic. I don't know where I was going. And anyway, I was listening to the radio, and the right-wing Rush Limbaugh clone on the radio was saying, "Look, everybody, even Susan Rice says that Gaddafi's troops are eating Viagra and going around and mass raping all the innocents of eastern Libya. So you know it's true if even the left liberal Obama administration admits it, right, everybody?" And all the Rush Limbaugh clone show listeners in the audience all nodded their heads. "Yes, I guess that is a compelling argument. If Susan Rice says something, then that's how you know it's true. Right, everybody?" They started a war on that. Can you believe that? It's not funny, but it's kind of funny. Like, geez, that's funny, because I didn't believe it for one second, not even for a second. Did you? Well, that sounds like maybe it's true. No, it doesn't. And anyway, of course, it was the Libya war that spread quickly to Mali as the Tuaregs fled home with all their weapons after they lost the war and decided autonomy wasn't good enough. They wanted independence from the south. So they went to war. And then very quickly after that, the Mujahideen followed them, marginalized them, and made it a jihad. And in fact, marched all the way to the south and the capital city, precipitating a coup d'etat, a military coup, and then eventually French intervention. All as consequence from the American war in Libya. And then I thought this was BS too, because they like to say, oh, all these groups have links, 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 and that excuses them going to war. But apparently, I don't remember all my footnotes now, but I remember reading some actual good journalism by, you know, independent-minded people that had it that, no, really, Boko Haram traveled up to Mali and met with the jihadists from the Libya war, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, Obama's KKK legions, veterans of Iraq War II, where they fought Americans under Zarqawi, and trained with them. And I guess they gave him some doctrine and some weapons and sent him home to be even worse than they were before. And of course, Boko Haram already was a reaction to colonialism in the first place. But anyway, now, as I told you yesterday, it's at news. Look, everything, okay, everything is at news.antiwar.com. The heroic Jason Ditz. News.antiwar.com. U.S. sends ground troops and drones to Cameroon to fight Boko Haram. That intervention in Libya made worse. Much worse. Anyway, Hillary actually in the debate the other night apparently spun the Libya war as a success. Hey, we were able to get rid of Gaddafi. And so that was a real challenge. And that's all you need to know. You know, the places, there's no such place as Libya anymore at all. It's just, it's two competing governments. The jihadis in the West now, and the American CIA secular fascist sock puppet types more centered in the East, which is kind of an interesting development. But basically, the place is just a wasteland, a graveyard. It's chaos, Stan. Because America made it that way. Who was it wrote the great thing? Oh, you know what? I think it may have been Paul Pilar. No, it wasn't Paul Pilar. Somebody wrote a great thing about Libya, about Hillary Clinton. And oh, I know what it was. It was Connor Friedersdorf at The Atlantic. And maybe he was quoting somebody else. I don't know. But that was the article. And it was talking about how, you know, under the excuse making of the American empire, any bad thing that happens on our watch is our fault because we allowed it to happen. But anything that happens because of what we did, well, that's the fault of the people who refuse to take advantage of the greatness we offered them. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And thanks, y'all. All right, you guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, do you ever read Yuri Avnery? He writes for, we publish him at antiwar.com. He's from Gush Shalom, which is a peace group, I guess. zope.gush-shalom.org. Yeah, what you do, you just search his name, Yuri Avnery, or just look in his archive at antiwar.com. This one will be running on antiwar.com tomorrow. It's called The Settlers Prussia. It's very interesting. I was going to say about Yuri. He fought for Israel in the 1948 war. He is a OG Zionist and is now a peacenik. And I guess, I don't know if he's a communist, but he's very much a left peacenik type on the Israeli spectrum. So anyway, what he writes about here is Arnold Toynbee and Oswald Spengler and their histories of the rise and fall of empires. And how Toynbee, I guess, especially focuses on, talks about how what happens in the empire is the people out on the frontier are tougher than the people who get rich and fat and lazy in the interior, and they end up taking the interior over. And this has happened time and again, and he really goes into the history of Germany to a great extent, but he also talks about other examples in history as well, including ancient Greece and Rome and et cetera like that. And he's saying that this is what's happening in Israel right now, that the people who are rich and fat and lazy and happy in Tel Aviv, they don't really have the heart to fight to keep what's best about what they got and prevent the worst. The settlers, on the other hand, they have to be tough, even though obviously they have the advantage. They are still occupying other people's land, and they are, you know, under military armed guard at all times and are threatened with rocks from time to time. And they just live, he says, a hardier life
they are more dependent upon the martial virtues, etc., like this. And guess what? They're taking over Israel. And the peacenik left hardly exists at all in any organized form as far as a political movement. There are only multiple flavors of Likud at this point. There's Netanyahu, and there's everybody to the right of him. And the people who are supposedly to the left of him are just as bad on the settler movement. Nobody calls it the West Bank anymore. It's all Judea and Samaria now. And there will never be peace, and they tell each other and themselves whatever lies they need to justify it. Like, compromise is what causes intifada, not tyranny, etc., etc. And this is the real battle for Israel. That's what Yuri Avnery says. And I think this is the lesson, the story that Max Blumenthal has been trying to explain for quite a few years now, is that he first put out, long before the book Goliath, he put out this video, Feeling the Hate in Jerusalem. And he's asking, and these are mostly Americans, by the way, or I don't know, no, I guess that's not true, mostly, but including Americans, but asking these young Israelis, dual citizens or what they think about Obama, and they sound like, you know, as bad or worse than a bunch of racist white Southerners talking about Obama. And, yeah, you know, they say the kind of words that I couldn't quote them saying on a nice family show like this. And so when I talked to him back then, Max Blumenthal said, here's the thing about Israeli society that he had learned, was that they are too far gone now. They're so far, the whole society has moved so far to the right now, it's a self-licking ice cream cone. A clone of a self-licking ice cream cone, as someone was using that phrase the other day, or earlier in the chat room in a different context. They're basically making such enemies out of the Palestinians that only a right-wing military form of government can protect them from the enemies they're making. This kind of thing. And so they're just moving further and further and further to the right, as they settle, that is, steal more and more and more of especially the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Also, as Dan Sanchez wrote, expanding in the Golan Heights as well. The Gaza Strip, they apparently don't really want, or maybe they'll get to it someday. Right now, they're content to keep it a concentration camp, mostly for children, or at least, you know, minors, teenagers and children. Not who have been convicted of anything other than not being Jewish, which is a felony. And they just live in squalor in the Gaza concentration camp. At some point, you know, quite a few Israeli parliamentarians from time to time have come out saying that, yes, eventually they're going to have to, quote unquote, kick all the Palestinians, again, a majority of them under 18, out of the Gaza Strip and take it too. Push them into the Sinai Desert where they can lay down and die or whatever. As one of Netanyahu's ministers said, Israel is for the white man. He said that in context of kicking Ethiopian refugees out of the country. Well, they're Jewish, but wrong skin color, so might as well be a Palestinian Christian or Muslim. Anyway, so there you go, man. Important point, I think. Important parallel. Seems like an apt metaphor. Yuri Avnery. It'll be running tomorrow on antiwar.com. The settlers, Prussia. Those who are in the act of stealing the West Bank are the ones in charge of the government now. Many of the ministers actually do live in the occupied territories. So. I'm not imagining any happy endings. I mean, I can imagine decent sort of endings, you know, solutions to the problem going on there now, but I'm not predicting any of them. It's an ugly situation, man. And that was my point about the Max Blumenthal thing. It's just getting worse. It ain't coming back. The pendulum ain't swinging back. This is the deal now. So, anyway. All right, cool. Well, in 10 seconds, the music will start playing. And then when we get back from this break, I'll tell you more news. I got Afghanistan, important. Oh, I still got some Israel-Palestine stuff, actually, to mention to you. I've got Afghanistan, Iran, important Iran news, and there's another one about Iran. Yeah, and like that. And we'll be back right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Well, if you've listened this long, you must really like the show. So, how about supporting it? If you have a business and you want to advertise on the show, you'd be surprised at just what a great deal I would give you to advertise on the Scott Horton Show. Just give me a call and send me an email, scott@scotthorton.org, and we can work something out, see if we can make some money. If you have, you know, a nonprofit type group thing, you want people to donate to it, that kind of deal, I'm okay at pitching those too, I think. That is, you know, if you want to have a Scott Horton Show to keep listening to, because, you know, like everybody else, I got to make at least enough money to live, never mind having even a single silver coin worth of savings. But I have to live, or I'm going to take Scott Brown's class at Master Samurai Tech and go repair refrigerators for a living, which actually sounds not too bad to me at this point. And I bet I could talk him into giving me a deal. But, you know, anyway, if you want to advertise, be like Scott Brown, like MasterSamuraiTech.com, and advertise on the show. That way I can have some money and you can hopefully make some more money. You know, Tim Frey over at Roberts and Roberts Brokerage Inc. let me know the other day that he's done some business some business that have mentioned that they heard about him on my show. Whew. I hope that means he's going to stay around. See, it works. I says to him, hey man, if you're going to buy some silver or gold or platinum or palladium, go to these guys. You can trust them. They've been around for a long time. They're decent people and they take a very small, reasonable cut. Shop them around. You'll love them. RRBI.co. RRBI.co. And, they did. Some of you did. So good. Keep doing that. And thank you for proving that it's worthwhile to advertise on this show. So that goes for the rest of you, too. And now those of you who have a job for a living and can't really buy advertisements, you can still donate. And y'all get kickbacks. Anybody donates $50 or more gets the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism narrated by me. Or Beyond Democracy, narrated by Jeff Riggenbach, or any other title offered by Listen and Think Audio for free. Anybody who donates $50, which actually reminds me, I think I owe somebody an audiobook now that I think about it. I better write that down. I need to go back through my emails. But the rest of you, though, you can count on me, man. I'll get right to it. Somebody and audiobook. Yeah, and then here's the other thing. If you donate $100 to the show, could I get 5 of you guys to donate $100 to the show this month? If you did, you either get a 1-ounce QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com, a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman, or Red, Blue, or Broke All Over by Charles Goyette. I will send you those things in the mail. You want a Sheldon Richman book? You want a Charles Goyette book? They're great books. You want a silver disc with a QR code on the back so it tells you how much it's worth in real time. I think it's the greatest currency ever invented. Thank you very much. I guess you do kind of have to have a smartphone in order to use it well, but everybody does anyway. It's like you're going to have to buy a smartphone now because you've got a QR code disc, so come on. I think they're awesome. Scan it with your phone, tells you the instant spot price. All right, and anyone who donates $200 to the show, and hey, listen, I know it's a lot of money, $200, but a few of you probably could afford it. And if you do, and you donate $200 to this show, then Derek Sheriff of Listen and Think Audio will give you a lifetime subscription to every libertarian or other, but they're all libertarian, I think, audiobook ever done by Listen and Think Audio, which is a couple dozen of them now, or ever will do, which is going to be scores and scores and hopefully hundreds and hundreds of audiobooks, libertarian audiobooks, from now on. So if you commute a lot and my show and Tom Wood's show can't get you through, check out some libertarian audiobooks. You donate $200 to this show, you get them free forever. And Derek even said, I swear he did say this, Derek Sheriff at Listen and Think Audio said they can pass on their lifetime subscription to their heirs, man. I don't care. As long as Listen and Think Audio works, this deal will be honored. Anybody who donates $200 to this show gets a lifetime subscription. Not your lifetime, but Listen and Think Audio's. And he's a young guy. Not very young, but somewhat young. He's going to live a long, long time. Listen and Think Audio, any and every audiobook they have ever done or ever will do if you donate $200 to this show. And if you go to scotthorton.org/donate, there's buttons. Also, I don't know, they got hacked, and so maybe people are worried about it, but it seems like it's all right now. I don't know, a few people are using it. Patreon.com, especially if you want me to shut up and just do the interviews. You want to incentivize me to do more interviews and less yapping of my own, then I guess you go over and sign up at patreon.com and you can donate on a per interview basis. 25 cents, $1.50, whatever, $1 million, whatever you think is right. You can donate on a per interview basis and you can cap it and whatever so it doesn't break your bank, that kind of thing. patreon.com/Scott Horton Show if you want to know more about that. And bitcoins. Yes, I love bitcoins. And yes, I notice every few weeks or so, I open up my bitcoin wallet and look, and people send me fractions of bitcoins and I love them. And I only wish now, oh, if I could turn back the clock. I only wish that in 2009 I had saved them all up in different wallets on different thumb drives and sent them home to Ma for safekeeping. Until the gigantic bubble of 2013. Then I would be $1 million and I would be $1 million. I would be $1 million with millions of dollars. And none of you would ever hear from me again. But nope, I can't do magic. So, but anyway, I do love the bitcoins, whether they're in a bubble or whether they're not. If you go to scotthorton.org/donate, you can find my Bitcoin and my Litecoin address there. You don't need PayPal to send a one-off donation by way of PayPal. To do a monthly donation, you do, I guess. I think. But if you want to do a, I could be wrong about that. But if you want to do a one-off donation, you don't need a PayPal account. You just, you know, put it on whatever card. And yeah, there you go. All the buttons and all the things you need or want are right there at, ScottHorton.org/donate for helping the show. And seriously, by all means, would you please stop by the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org and patronize my sponsors too. The War State and Wall Street Window. The War State Book and Wall Street Window Investment Advice by Mike Swanson. The aforementioned Samurai Tech Academy. The Council for the National Interest. That's Phil Giraldi's group. And then there's the new one is MPV Engineering. I know not most of you are in the middle of running big industrial projects, but if you are, this guy can definitely hook you up. It's Christopher Smith at MPV Engineering. And you can find the link there at scotthorton.org. There's liberty.me where I do two shows with Jacob Hornberger and with Jeff Tucker there. Liberty.me. The Future Freedom Foundation, of course, Hornberger's Foundation, FFF.org, and subscribe to their journal, The Future Freedom. It's really great. LibertyStickers.com. I used to own it. I made up all the meanest ones on there. The ones with the crappy graphics but the really good slogans, those ones are mine. LibertyStickers.com. Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. Darren's Coffee Company. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, wrapping up here. Mark Lee's going to be back on the show on Monday to talk about Turkey. Kelly Vallejo is also going to be here on Monday to talk about Egypt. And Keegan Steffen on the murderer cops. The endless list of murderer cops. All right. Back to the news here. IAEA met deadline. Nuclear inquiry completed. Final report scheduled for release in mid-December. Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. The International Atomic Energy Agency today confirmed that Iran has met all deadlines on their long-standing investigation into past atomic activities and that the inquiry has concluded. The final report on the IAEA inquiry is due to be delivered by mid-December. This is meant to cap many years of investigation and resolve the repeated allegations of secret Iranian nuclear activities, though history suggests there will be new rounds of allegations backed without evidence. Suddenly, I don't know why backed is in there, but anyway. Backed by no evidence. Suddenly emerging to keep the IAEA from closing this outright. I'm not so sure. Maybe. But then it's up to Amano and the IAEA whether they want to, accept new information like that into the stream. For example, the so-called possible military dimensions they're dealing with now, their previous director, Mohammed El-Baradei, had refused to, accept as official documents. He said, these aren't really credible. There's no proof that they're legitimate in the first place. And then his successor decided, for political reasons, of course, as proven in the WikiLeaks, thank you, Chelsea Manning, doing 35 years in the brig. But anyway, ever since the deal,
the Iranians have given over, whatever. And if you've read Gareth Porter's book, or if you've heard Gareth Porter on the show, you know that all this is going to be resolved, no problem, because it's all a bunch of crap anyway. Yeah, 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 the Israelis made up some lies. What is it that they said they did, that we did with the thing? Nope, here it is, right here. Disproven. Next. So, there you go. The Iranians have turned over. The IAEA says it's done. Meaning, I guess, the Iranians have finished answering. The IAEA still has to put together their final report about whether they still think they have ongoing questions or not. But they've apparently accepted that the Iranians have at least taken a shot at answering every outstanding question about their nuclear program. And since they never had a nuclear weapons program and this whole thing is a manufactured crisis in the first place, I think there's reason to be optimistic they're going to go ahead and get past this. You know, Mossad can crank out some new forgeries, but who is bound to accept them when the empire isn't looking for forgeries? You know, there are times when the Americans are perfectly happy to say, oh, some suspicious new Israeli forgeries pretending to be Iranian documents, huh? Well, we're going to refer you to the Security Council and this and that and whatever, and new sanctions on you if they want. But right now, that's not what the empire wants. So, why accept the lie? I don't know. I shouldn't be too optimistic about this Iran deal going into play. I saw, remember that guy that I had on that debated Phil Giraldi about Iran and Iraq? Forgot his name, but I saw him pretending today that Iran sending the head of the Quds Force to Syria is a violation of the Iran nuclear deal. On Twitter, he said that. Didn't explain how so or anything. He linked to an article that said, well, there are sanctions on him that say he's not allowed to leave Iran. Well, but who all is bound by those sanctions? It was probably the Iraqi government, the Shiistan government that America put in power there that helped him get there, wouldn't you think? And anyway. And then Jason Ditz also has this one. U.S. falsely claims Iran missile test is a violation of a U.N. resolution. Just a day after Iran's Guardian Council approved the P5+1 nuclear deal, the U.S. is already showing extremely bad faith, with Ambassador Samantha Power claiming Iran had violated a U.N. resolution with a recent missile test. The resolution in question is 1929, which was itself created in response to the already resolved nuclear issue. The resolution forbids Iran from developing ballistic missiles for developing nuclear warheads. The U.S. is falsely treating this as a ban on all ballistic missile improvements, even though the missile Iran tested is simply an improved version of the Shahab 3 missile with better accuracy and is not designed for nuclear arms. UN Resolution 1929 is part of a set of sanctions and bans that was already clearly on the way out after the ratification of the P5+1 nuclear deal, and clearly was not intended to forbid Iran from making improvements to its own conventional military arsenal in the first place. The U.S. allegation, then, is doubly problematic and a bad first sign on how the U.S. is going to treat the post-deal situation. Well, there's so much for being stupidly optimistic for 2.5 minutes, Scott Horton. There's Jason Ditz to disabuse me of any, you know, optimism along those lines. And then, hey, let me bring this up again. The drone papers from yesterday at The Intercept. I haven't had a chance to go through them all yet. Nick Turse here has Target Africa, the U.S. military's expanding footprint in East Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. But there's a lot more than that. I did read, and we're running today as the spotlight on antiwar.com, The Assassination Complex, a visual glossary of what all they're talking about in the PowerPoint here. The Kill Chain, which we discussed with the author Cora Currier on the show yesterday, and her other piece is called Firing Blind, co-written with Peter Mass. Then there's Find, Fix, and Finish by Scahill, Manhunting in the Hindu Kush by Ryan Devereaux, the life and death of Objective Peckham, which is about Somalia, and then Target Africa by Terse, and then the documents. So all that is at theintercept.com/dronepapers. Weekend coming up. Hopefully you get a little bit of time. Put some time aside to sit and go through this. I hope I can find the time to do it. If I wait 2 weeks, it's going to get away from me, man. I got to do it. Read them all. Hopefully get some more good interviews out of it all, too. But, yeah, man, there you go. That's The Intercept. Oh, yeah, and you know what, man? At the part of the show where I was pretending to be NPR boy and asking for donations and all that crap, hey, you want to have to listen to NPR instead of me while you're driving around? Wouldn't that suck? All right, you better donate to the show then. You're going to be listening to NPR boy giving you the same speech, only a lot worse. But anyway, part of that, I was going to say, hey, man, the interview-only feed at iTunes was broken for a long, long time. Now it's back again. All the comments and rankings and everything were deleted. So now it's as though instead of having one of the longest-running podcasts in iTunes history up there, I have basically a brand-new one. I don't know for sure, but I assume I lost all the people who had subscribed to it before. Well, now it's back up there, and it sure could use some stars and some comments from those of you who like the show, you know, if you like the show. And same thing at Stitcher. You can find the Just the Interviews feed or the actual feed. You can sign up for those feeds there. And you can leave comments if you want to help recommend the show to people, something like that. I looked at the iTunes thing this morning because there was a problem with one of the interviews. And I looked at it, and there were no stars and no reviews, and it said, there are no reviews, so therefore there's no ranking on this podcast yet. And I thought, don't! I've had a feed through them on there since, I think, 2005 or 4. And on a daily basis since 2007, since the beginning of 2007. And, yeah, oops. Well, the server broke and it stayed broke and I got kicked off of there and then it took forever to get them to put it back again. Forever. So anyway, that's the way that is. It's not much, right? If you like the show, go and say, yeah, I like the show. He's all right. You know, when he's not talking, it's pretty good, I guess. When he lets the other guy talk. All right. So that's the end of me for the week. Thanks you guys very much for listening. Thanks very much, especially to all you guys who already do help support. Very appreciative of that. And know me this Sunday on KPFK, but I'll be back here Monday.